Watanabe at Cisco.
Hi, Kate. Connie Huntington.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome. This is Sue Bethanas. I think we've got enough to this point. We'll add people as we go here. Welcome to Wise Talk, Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Tonight our topic is, or actually it's today, in California, for those of you joining us from East Coast, it's tonight. Our topic today is pressed for time. What would you do with an extra hour? My name is Sue Bethanas. I'm the president of Mariposa Leadership, and I'm your host tonight. I'm pleased that our guest today is Janet Crawford. She's the principal of Crawford Consulting, and she's a senior consultant with us, Mariposa. Janet and I go way back. She's actually the first person that I brought in to Mariposa in 1996, and she also has a thriving practice on her own. As a former scientist and manager at the EPA, she brings a much-needed voice to coaching on the relationship between biology and leadership. Janet and I are going to explore three topics in today's forum. The first is the state of overwhelm. That obviously works into our topic very well in terms of what to do with an extra hour. The second topic is time and task management. So we're going to talk about some specifics and some practical advice that she's got for us. And the third one is on work and family integration. We do have a full house tonight, there's 25 of you, which I'm so happy about. This is going very well these last 3 months. And I very much thank all of you for joining us. It's a wide mix of people, both in large corporations and coaches and consultants. I know some of you are here just to listen. Others of you will have questions. After each topic, I will definitely call for questions because I want to make sure this is as relevant as possible for all of you. As a matter of decorum, I am going to ask you to identify who you are to the group before you make your comments or ask a question. And I suggest if you are in a listening mode that you please put your phone on mute by pressing *6. And you can also unmute by pressing *6 again. And if you're on your cell phone or traveling, please put us on mute. We are recording this session, and so if you have friends or colleagues that are interested, you can go to our website next week and go into our archive section, and you'll be able to listen to this again or obviously have your friends or colleagues. Any questions so far, now that all of you have gone on to mute? So, any questions about where we're going today? Anybody? All right. So, the first topic of the state of overwhelm. Janet, welcome very much for coming and being here today.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Yeah. It's a treat for me to have you with me today. First question I have is about juggling, and I'm sure this is going to be apropos to all of us. You're going to get on this phone call. It's hard sometimes. So what kind of juggling are you seeing people tackle these days? And the follow-up to that is it different than it was like 5 to even 10 years ago? Do you see any differences?
Well, I think that what I'm seeing, especially in my clients, which are mostly executives in high-tech and biotech companies, is a kind of overwhelm in the numbers of things that they're trying to juggle. Multiple job responsibilities, working too many hours, meeting overload, having an entire day back-to-back scheduled with meetings, and yet also having to manage their staff, read emails, and produce product at that same time.
Mm-hmm.
So double, triple booking. And then on top of that, working these long hours and having life and family responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. You see that different? I mean, that sounds like what I am seeing as well. I'm wondering, from your vantage point, is it that different than what it was maybe 10 years ago? And I know we were doing this work 10 years ago. Is it that different, or is it the same?
I don't think it's that different, but I think that there are a couple of factors that have changed. One is that 10 years ago, a lot of the people that I was working with were very young, and they were looking at huge stock options. So the idea was, it's okay if I work in this state of overwhelm because there's going to be this enormous payoff
mm-hmm.
in the short term. That's now become the norm. That kind of work behavior, but the payoff isn't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because of the layoffs that have happened in the last 5 years or so, a lot of these people are doing even more than they were doing before with less staff.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was also just an accelerated promotion that happened in that early stage of biotech and high tech, where a lot of people got promoted beyond their training.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden they're in high positions, and then they lose a lot of their staff. So that also, I think, just exacerbates that sense of overwhelm that was already there to begin with.
Mm-hmm. So you talked a lot about people who are, we consider our clients. What about those of us who are in the business of coaching and consulting? What about overwhelm for us? I mean, do you see anything there?
I see some of the same issues, and I also think that for the people that are in consulting and coaching, one of the issues that we have is being able to get access to our clients who are overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Because their schedules are changing so frequently, and if you're coaching 10 or 15 people and they're all experiencing this schedule overwhelm and trying to shift when they want to do appointments, there's just that logistical issue and also the regularity of appointments, but also the additional difficulty that you might have in getting someone to do a regular practice.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Just, there's so much going on. To do any regular practice is tough, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that makes sense.
So you really have to keep things at a manageable level, something that they can do as a thought practice or a very quick in-the-moment practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I know you have a lot of background in the biological basis of stress, and I know I always enjoy listening to your ideas about that. So tell us about what actually happens to us when we're under this kind of stress, this overwhelm that we're experiencing.
Well, we're not really designed to be in constant overwhelm. We have a really good biological system for episodic overwhelm. So what our body does when it is experiencing overwhelm and too many things is it produces a lot of chemicals that really amp us up so
mm-hmm.
that we're able to respond. But those chemicals aren't really very good for our body. And so oftentimes what happens is that people get into a stress mode. They're flooded with stress hormones. And because there's no kind of period in between where they can settle back down and let their body clear out, what those chemicals do is they actually heighten the response to stress in the future. So if I've got my body pumped full of stress hormones and something comes along that's a minor trigger or a minor stress, I'm more likely to react to that in a major way. And that floods my body with more chemicals. And then you can see how that cycle just continues itself. So all of a sudden you have people that are working together under high stress and they're reacting to a lot of situations that they don't necessarily need to be reacting to, at least as in as exaggerated form as they're reacting to it.
And we had talked actually a couple weeks ago about there's some new research about the relationship with caffeine and how that's even making this worse.
Yes, because one of the things about caffeine is that it tends to increase our trigger ability so that we react to things as though they were stressors.
Mm.
It tips our body over already into a tendency toward a stress response. And one of the very insidious things, actually frightening things that we're finding out about that, is that when you keep your body in that kind of a position all of the time, you have neural death in your brain all the time. You know, neurons dying and then neurons regrowing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a normal process. But what we're finding is that when people are living in that kind of a stress reaction mode, which caffeine really worsens significantly, the neuron regrowth in the parts of the brain that are really responsible for higher level thinking slows down.
Mm.
So you've got neuron death, and you don't have a replacement rate. So you're actually net losing neurons there,
mm-hmm.
but you get a higher replacement rate in the amygdala of the brain. And
mm-hmm.
the amygdala is the part of the brain that is responsible for scanning the environment for danger and causing you to react.
Okay. Let's talk about the
amygdala. You're making your amygdala stronger and the thinking part of your brain weaker.
Weaker. So let's talk about the amygdala because I know that that's key in terms of dealing with stress. So there's the amygdala hijack.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about that and what we can do to prevent having an amygdala hijack.
So essentially, I mean, this is brain science condensed into a paragraph.
Yes.
You have three parts in your brain. You have a neocortex, which is responsible for all the higher level thinking that we think about as being human thinking, all that these reasoning and logical powers that we have that other animals don't have. We have a limbic system, which is the emotional center of the brain. And interestingly enough, that's also the center of the brain that's responsible mostly for decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a reptilian brain, which is really the part of the brain that is survival oriented. Now,
that's where the amygdala is.
Well, the amygdala kind of lives in the limbic system, but it's like the gateway or the portal to the reptilian brain.
Mm-hmm.
It is really what decides whether your higher brain should be dealing with a situation or your reptilian or lower brain should be dealing with it.
Okay.
And see, the reptilian brain can only do three things. It can cause you to, it's the fight, flight, and freeze response center.
Right.
So you can run away, you can fight it off, or you can shut down.
Right.
And that's what we see happening in meetings when people get stage fright, for example, or somebody challenges them in a meeting and they act as though they had just been attacked and they fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And you know it's an amygdala hijack when you didn't have choice about it. When later on you think, why did I do that?
Okay.
Or I wish I hadn't been that way, but somehow I just couldn't avoid it.
So the idea of the hijack is literally it's unconscious. We can't stop it.
Right.
And so what we want to be able to do in those moments is to be aware that it's coming on and be able to stop it before it gets us, essentially.
Absolutely.
And so say a little bit about how we can tell that we're ready to have an amygdala hijack.
Well,
it's going to be different for us, different people.
I want to back up even further and say that the most important thing is to train yourself not to have one way before it's happening.
Right, exactly.
And that is, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit more, self-care in all of its forms, exercise, diet, relaxation, meditation, all of those things are huge because if you look at the reactivity of people's brains who are practicing those things, they will trigger their amygdalas at a much lower response rate than people who are not practicing good self-care.
Like monks, for example.
Yeah, like monks rarely trigger amygdalas. I mean, you can put them on a brain scan, and they're extremely calm, even under stressful situations.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be very resourceful, i.e., they can think very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you take a lot of very stressed-out executives or stressed-out new mothers or you name it, and you test them under stress, they will trigger very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So the key is to really take care of yourself so that you're not triggering. However, there in the short term, you really can train yourself to tell when an amygdala response is coming on. And what that requires is some really careful self-observation. So it's noticing what happens right before the amygdala hijack and then what happened right before that. Because usually there's a period, and it's very, very brief, but there's a brief conscious period where we know that we're starting to get amped up. And if you catch yourself in that very brief moment, you can do some practices to stop the amygdala hijack from coming on. Now, once you're in the full under the power of an amygdala hijack, it's too late.
Right.
Because what's going to happen is that the neural connections between the lower centers of the brain and the upper centers of the brain are shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So even though you can think consciously, oh boy, I shouldn't be saying this, it's coming out of your mouth anyway.
Yeah, that's what happened to me this morning when, when I got a parking ticket. And it was the second parking ticket in a row, you know, living in San Francisco. They're giving parking tickets now for parking more than 18 inches away from the curb.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, not kidding. Yeah, my amygdala went off this morning for sure. So so I guess what I think what people would want to know about is the idea that we can catch it before we, as we're feeling the amp up, essentially, in terms of self-observation. And at that point, what could people do? Take a breath or, you know?
Breathing is huge because one of the natural mm-hmm. physiological responses to stress is that we hold our breath.
Mm-hmm.
So breathing again and actually having something that you say to yourself at that moment can also help.
Great.
Breathing is the biggest.
Breathing. Mm-hmm.
If you have a meditation practice, you also know how to relax the muscles in your body. That
mm-hmm.
helps.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, stretching, and this is going to sound strange, but stretching across your body. So if you put your right hand on your left knee and just stretch, has a physiological effect because the part of the brain that connects the different parts, the different levels of the brain, your left side of your brain controls the right side of the body and vice versa. And when you stretch across your body, you have to fire a lot of nerve impulses across your brain. And it actually wakes that center of the brain that connects it, the different parts up. It wakes it up.
Cool.
And so that's really helpful in the moment just to kick off, you know, to take you down just one notch so that you're not going to trigger.
That sounds great. I haven't heard that one yet.
Yeah,
so
it's actually very cool.
That's a good one. I'll have to try that one. So let's bring it out to our audience here. Who has a question for Janet at this point? It could be anything about your own situation, or it can be about your boss, or it could be about your kids, whatever you'd like to ask Janet at this point about what we've been talking about in terms of overwhelm and the biological basis. State who you are and your question.
Janet, my name is Angie Kutlick. I have a question about the state of overwhelm that you see with executives and that you see in general. What have you seen that do to productivity? I would imagine that logically that it would bring it down, but how do you see that affecting organizational productivity?
I think it affects organizational productivity profoundly. And the interesting thing is that people get into this overwhelmed spin cycle, and they're working harder and harder, but they're producing less and less because a lot of their effort is going into the anxiety and the overwhelm rather than into producing something. And so they have the sense that they're working really, really hard, but a lot of the work that they're doing is actually not productive work. And we're actually going to talk about that when we talk about time management and work-life balance a little bit.
Great question. Thank you, Angie.
I also had a comment, too, about the stretching exercise. I do the testing. I proctor testing for the Gifted and Talented program in my school district here. And an interesting thing that I had learned, that I was trained to learn, is to tell, I test second graders, little kids, is that very same thing, is to cross the midline helps to give your brain a break. So I've got these second graders that are doing these kind of stretches. They look totally ridiculous. They're having a blast, and it really does work, so I do second that.
Yes, it's amazing how it works. And
an
interesting side note for those of you who are parents or know someone who has a small child, that part of the brain that connects up the different levels, it's specifically that connects the limbic or emotional center of the brain to the neocortex or the higher logical centers of the brain, that develops as children are learning to crawl. And it's precisely because in order to crawl, you have to coordinate to the two sides of the body doing opposite motion, and that's what develops that nerve center.
Hmm. Very cool.
So, you know, it survives into adulthood. Anytime you cross over your body, you're going to fire those nerve impulses in that part of the brain.
Cool. Other questions for Janet? Or comments? Okay. Let's move on to the next topic of time management. So I know that Janet, you've actually been teaching and coaching based on a system, time management system by David Allen. I know that could be, you know, a couple of hours worth right now, but if you could give us some of the highlights of that and way you've actually morphed it into your own, and then we can talk about the actual resources here too.
So the way that most people have been taught to do time management is to make a to-do list and then assign priorities. What's the top priority, second priority, third priority, and then make a commitment to doing the top priority. And that sounds logical, but it's actually not congruent with the way we live our life or the way our brain works. So in the David Allen system and in the way that I've adapted that system, there are really three parts to it that are critical. One is that you spend some time downloading onto paper every single thing that you need to do in your life. And I don't care if it's professional or personal. And actually, David Allen would recommend going around your house and opening every single drawer. And I know that this sounds completely overwhelming, but it works. Look at everything. If there's a chip in the paint on your car that's bothering you and every time you look at it you think, I really want to get that repaired, put it on the list. If there's a problem with your technology at work and you need to contact IT about it, it goes on the list. So every single thing that would ever pop into your brain as something I need to do gets put onto a list. And actually the way that works the best is to put it on separate pieces of paper, each one, because there's a next step that you're going to do. And that is that you organize all of those items into piles according to the context in which that task needs to be done. So, for example, all of the phone calls would get put in one stack, and all of the errands that have to do with, you know, when you're out in your car, you need to pick something up, those go in one stack. And everything that has to be done while you're seated at a computer goes in one stack. And it doesn't matter if it's personal or professional. We're going to organize your life by the context in which things occur. The reason we do that is because it doesn't help you to have a to-do list of 200 items when you're driving along in the car and you have a moment to make a phone call. What you really want to have is a list of all the phone calls that you need to make with the phone number next to it. That way, when you're in a context and you're parked outside waiting for someone to come out of the drugstore, you pick up your list and your cell phone and you knock off a bunch of phone calls. So the key is that you have whatever you need in the context where work could happen. So that's part number two, organize into context. The third thing is that as you look at your to-do list, you want to separate out things that are projects and things that are tasks. Only things that are tasks go onto a to-do list. A task means that it's one action. It's a phone call, it's an errand at a particular store, etc. A project is something that's multitasked. So, for example, for me, getting certification from the International Coach Federation is a project. It's not a task. Now, that's something that's been on my to-do list for a long time. But when I started using this system, that got taken off of my to-do list and it went onto a project list. And the project list is something that when you look at a project, you then break it down into all the separate tasks and you put those tasks onto those different lists. So all the phone calls that have to do with ICF certification go on my phone call list. What happens to people is that they put a project on their to-do list and it's too overwhelming because you don't know where to start and you don't know where the finish line is. So there's no way you can ever check that off, and even though it's the most important thing you have to do, you will gravitate toward the thing that you can actually check off your to-do list. So those are the three parts. Download everything, organize it into context, and make sure that you've separated projects from tasks.
Wow, that's very, very efficient, the way you just explained that. Great. So especially because our listeners may not think they have time to read his books.
That's essentially it right there.
Yeah. What would you say the best way is to get started on this?
I would say, you know, I've worked with a lot of different people around this particular way of managing time, and I have not yet found somebody that it did not work for. But what I have found is that there are people who are very detail-oriented who just love it. They go and they immediately get a stack of paper and go through their entire office and their entire home. That works for a few people. Mm-hmm. But mostly what I think is useful is that you just sit down and with the most critical places that you, like your desk, sit down at your desk and try to gather every to-do that you could find at your desk. And just start at that level and get it organized into context. Mm-hmm. And then when you're used to using it at that level, expand it out and say, hey, I'm going to attack my garage this weekend and figure out what all the tasks are in there. Mm-hmm. And so you just keep going through different areas of your life and implementing the system. But start with one discrete area that you think is going to make a big difference.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I know that I can say this to the group, that I've actually listened to Janet give this talk to our company, and it made a difference to me and to a lot of us. And the biggest thing that I want to share what I thought was the most impactful thing that you said, which is that once you get these things out of your system, literally you're getting them onto pieces of paper or you know even a paper, it's like your energy isn't zapped by holding it in your head. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, was the most amazing thing because it makes more sense. It makes total sense. And if you can get it out of you, then you don't have to hold it, and you have more energy.
Well, it's interesting, Sue, because, if you look at the biological basis of this, the human brain is really not designed as an information storage and retrieval or on-demand mm-hmm. retrieval system. Mm-hmm. We can store a lot of information, but the way we retrieve it, it's fairly random. So I'm sure most of our listeners have had the experience of, like, going to the hardware store, and you're there, and you have, like, five items that you know you need to pick up, and then you get home and you realize that you forgot to pick one of them up.
Mm-hmm.
Or you think, oh, my goodness, you know, while I was at the hardware store, I should have gotten light bulbs. Now, when do you remember you should have gotten the light bulb? It's when you turn on that light that's broken.
Right.
And you think, oh, I was just at the hardware store. Why didn't I remember to buy a light bulb? It's because your brain is actually not designed to remind you in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So you get hugely more efficient when you put everything down on paper. The moment you notice that there's a light bulb missing, you put it on your errand under hardware store. And then you don't have to use your brain to remember that. And you also don't have to make an extra trip to the hardware store. And you'd be amazed at how that adds up over the course of a day.
Exactly. You're not making more than one trip. Yeah. And again, I would say even if you've got this list going and you have something on your list for a long time, at least it's out of you and onto a list. So even if you have to keep putting that on the list, at least it's not stuck in your brain. Would you say that's true? Or?
That's absolutely true. And one of the objections that I sometimes hear to this system is, well, won't I be overwhelmed when I see all of these things that have to be done on paper?
Mm.
Like, I'll have to actually consciously acknowledge that that's all there. And my response to that is, you know it anyway, only you know it in the back of your brain, and it's there eating at you constantly in the background.
Right.
When you get it out on paper,
right. There's
a kind of a purging that happens. Your brain is free to think about other things, and then you can look at one set of papers and say, okay, everything's out there. Which is the most important thing to do here?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we think about things, let's say in the middle of the night when people wake up and there's a sudden, oh, my goodness, I need to do this.
Right.
Usually you can't do anything about it right at that moment. But actually what has happened when you have that little emergency moment is that you've released a lot of stress hormones.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're having that happen throughout the day over and over again, in the middle of a meeting you remember, got to pick this up this morning. I have to remember to do it this afternoon. And what do you do all afternoon? Periodically you go, oh, yeah, please remember, I have to do this afternoon. I have to do this after I leave work. Well, it's a lot more efficient to put it on a piece of paper that goes with you everywhere you go.
Right.
You don't have to think about it anymore.
Yeah, we should call it like the creep syndrome or something. Put some name on it or something.
Well, if you look at historically, 1,000 years ago, which is an eye blink in terms of human evolution,
mm-hmm.
we really didn't have to remember very much. Each day was pretty much the same as the day before.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really not set up for the level of complexity that we're experiencing these days. And so most people think that there's something wrong with them, that they keep forgetting to do things, and they'll make jokes about having Alzheimer's. It's not that at all.
We're just not made up this way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
So I'm going to stop here because I think that I want to make sure people have a chance to ask questions about this particular topic of downloading everything, organizational piles based on context, and then delineating between projects and tasks. Who has a question for Janet on this?
I have a question. This is Dina Silver. And first of all, it's a very cool system. Thank you for sharing it. I can see certainly how it's an improvement, but I'm kind of curious. It's an improvement in an already bad situation. And I think what I'm curious about is what do you say to your clients just around the topic of letting go of some of the stuff on the list, because I don't actually think it's a successful solution for most of us to believe that it's reasonable to accomplish all of the things that we're expected to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and part of what happens, the act of putting it onto the list is not the same as the act of committing to do it.
Oh.
The only thing, the only thing that you're doing is when you have a thought that keeps pinging you about something that you should do, you put it on the list. And when you look at the list, that allows you to prioritize what you're going to choose to do or not do. Now, I have some things on my list that have been there for a year now, and I actually have relegated them to a category that's called someday. I either decide that I'm never going
to
do it. Yeah. I either decide that I'm never going to do it, and I commit to never doing it. It's not like I don't think I'll ever be able to do it. If it's a never, and if it comes off my list, I'm committing not to do it. But if it's one of those that I look at and I think I still would really like to do this, but I don't think it's feasible in my life in the next 6 months to a year, I want to take it off the active list and put it on a someday list. It's still there, so I don't have to remember every once in a while, oh, yeah, I'd like to do that someday. It's on a list. I can forget about it. I look at those lists once a week, and I evaluate them. And I take things off, or I bump them onto someday, or I bump them out of projects, and I put them into tasks. So I do list management once a week. But I'm not. I really want to be clear that because it's on the list does not mean you've committed to doing it.
It's a great distinction.
However, when you get everything down on the list, it gives you tremendous power about setting boundaries and priorities. Because you can look at that list and you can say, aha, this is what I've been trying to do. And as I look at it all written down, there's no way I can do that. Now, which are the things here that I'm going to have to take some actions and actually make some declines in my life? Go and have a conversation with someone and say, I'm not able to do that, or I'm choosing not to do this as part of my life or part of my job anymore. And we're going to get into that in a moment around requests and agreements, but that's a very key piece. It's actually getting an inventory of what it is that you're trying to handle so that you can make more powerful declines in your life.
Dina, do you have a follow-up to that at all?
Well, the only other question that I have that is a little bit of a follow-up is, can you point us to any actual statistical stuff that looks at, because you know how so many of these senior executives would like some proof that if they decrease the workload of their people, they would have higher productivity, so that when people go to them and say, you know, no way can do, they have something to point to.
I don't have anything that is a statistical study. Do you have, Sue?
No, not on what specifically you're asking for. Because I think what you said, if I'm not mistaken, is that productivity goes higher if you decrease the workload, which is not exactly what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Productivity will increase if the efficiency increases, which is, there's different ways to clearly have efficiency. One of them is the system. Another one is requests and agreements, which is what we're going to talk about in a minute. But do I have any stats on that right this moment? No. But could I get some? Yeah.
So I want to follow up to what Sue just said and say that there are really two issues. One is that there are simply people who are being asked to do more things than are humanly possible.
Yeah.
That's an issue. But an awful lot of the time that I work with clients where that's the claim, there's actually a lot of efficiency increases. And I'm not blaming anyone. I'm not saying that people are inefficient or less efficient than they used to be. But I think that we're being called upon to work differently now than we ever have been in the past, and people aren't being educated in how to do that. So that there are efficiency gains that are untapped. And a lot of what happens during the workday is that people are working very hard to accomplish something in a system that's not very effective. So we look both at the issue of, are there places where you need to say no, and how do you say that, but also, how do you get done what you need to get done as quickly and efficiently as possible?
Yeah, it's the redo, Dina, that we're talking about that I think is what is called upon in terms of lack of efficiency. What we see a lot is there's a constant redoing or duplication of work, uh-huh, because people are not clear in their agreements. And I don't know if we need statistics for that. I mean, I think we know for a fact that...
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, that if you're duplicating work, that it's obviously costing the company more money. So so I think that's really, really what we're looking at. And I want to get into requests and agreements. But before we do that, does anybody else have a question on the stuff we were just talking about with Janet?
Sue, it's Joe Knipe from NSU.
Hey, Joe.
Just a statistic, if you take a look at Don Reinertsen's book on developing products in half the time, just from a project standpoint, he has a really good curve in one of the chapters that shows when people get beyond 2.5 projects, their efficiency drops off drastically for major projects. So if you just want some stats for somebody who's looking for that, that's one thing just associated with projects.
What's the name of the book again?
Don Reinertsen's Developing Products in Half the Time. He's a Caltech professor.
Okay, Developing Products in Half the Time. Great.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to add to the redo thing comment, which is there's the actual physical redo that is caused by the inefficiency in the way requests are made, and there's also emotional redo, which is where people haven't paid attention to relationship and they haven't paid attention to the emotional context of work, and oftentimes label that as fluffy or unnecessary. And then there are emotional breakdowns, which cause a great deal of anxiety and productivity loss because people are forgetting things, or they're spending time at their desks fuming about something, or spending time in fear about how somebody might react to them. So all of that takes up a tremendous amount of bandwidth in our actual ability to process information and think clearly. So there's a lot of places where cleaning up the efficiency in the way work happens has a payoff.
Love that distinction between emotional and physical. That's great. Okay, let's get into request making. We use this system quite a lot at Mariposa, and we think it's an excellent medium or tool to get things done. So Janet, just talk a little bit about it, and then we'll ask some questions. People have some questions probably.
So the whole area of requests and agreements originally comes from a man named Fernando Flores and then some people before him. And it essentially looks at how does work get done. All work, when you think about it, is the results from a request. Somebody is making a request of you to do something, or you're requesting that somebody else do something. And then you coordinate action by making a request and coming to an agreement. And that can happen between groups or it can happen between individuals. But that's essentially the process that's going on all day long in any work setting, is that we're producing work as a result of a request, or we're asking somebody else to do part of a work project through a request. And so getting the way we make requests down right is a critical communication skill. So the short answer on this is that in any request, there are really five essential elements. There needs to be a clear requester, i.e. the person that's asking for work to be done, a clear requestee or recipient of the request, a future action that is being asked for, the conditions of satisfaction, so that's item number 4. In other words, I'll be satisfied that I've gotten what I've asked for when the following conditions have been satisfied, and then fifthly, time, when do I need it by? So any time that you're making a request, if you can check just quickly in your mind and make sure that all of those elements are clear, who's making the request, and it may not be you. It may be that you're making it on behalf of somebody else, so it needs to be clear who's asking for it. Who am I asking to do this specifically? And there needs to be a name attached to that. Does anybody have information on, or I think this should be done, are examples of there's actually no specific person that's getting asked. What's the future action? What are the conditions of satisfaction? And by when do I need it? Now, if I'm being asked to do something, I also want to check to make sure all five of those things are clear to me. Because if I'm not clear with that, I can't deliver an efficient response. So when I am the person who's receiving the request, I have some options in how I respond to it. I can say yes. I can say no. I can say, I don't know if I can do that or not. Let me consider it and get back to you by a certain date. Or I can say, I actually can't do what you're asking me to do, but I can do something else that may get you what you need, or at least help get you what you need. So I really have 4 options in responding. Now, a lot of the breakdowns in organizations have to do with requests that leave out one of those 5 essential elements, requesters that make the request, but they never close the loop by ensuring that they've gotten a response, In other words, somebody has said yes to their request and made a commitment to do it, or places where people don't have full access to all four of those responses. In other words, they always say yes, or they always say no, or they don't know how to say, you know, I think I can do it, but I need to check on something first, let me get back to you. So breakdowns happen when you don't have all of those responses available to you.
So five areas, the who, who's the requester,
mm-hmm.
who's the recipient,
mm-hmm.
the what's the action, the and what's the conditions of satisfaction,
mm-hmm.
and then the when.
Right.
Okay.
Which is a really nice way of remembering it.
Yeah.
Who, what, and when.
Right. And then the, on the receiving end, making sure you're asking, a lot of times we have to manage the person asking because, you know, the person asking may forget something.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's, let's go over them again. The five areas are, no, yes, I'll do that for you.
Well, I actually only gave four.
Oh, you gave four. Okay.
I gave four.
I gave
yes, I commit to doing that.
Okay.
No, which is essentially, I promise not to do that.
Which obviously people in Silicon Valley have a hard time doing.
Yeah.
We have a hard time saying no.
Right. And it, a quote that I loved, I don't remember who said it, was, if you can't say no, the value of your, you've devalued yes. You've devalued
yep.
the currency of your yes.
Awesome.
Because when you can't say no, what happens, and this goes back to the earlier question of overwhelm and too many tasks on your plate, it's a very common disease in Silicon Valley that people take on anything that gets asked of them,
mm-hmm.
and then they are way overcommitted, and by default, they're going to have to start reneging on some of their commitments.
Right, and then they make it worse. They don't tell the person that they're reneging.
Right, and yeah. it's very damaging to their own self-esteem in terms of their when you make a commitment and you don't come through on it, whether you're consciously aware of it or not, it's a very difficult thing for the psyche. But beyond that, it breaks down trust in the entire organization.
Right. And credibility. Because
when
yeah.
you work in an organization where everybody understands that yes doesn't really mean yes,
mm-hmm.
how do you really know who's going to come through and who's not going to come through?
Mm-hmm.
It's tremendously damaging to the productivity of that organization.
One of the things that we often talk about is the whole idea of under-promising and over-delivering.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you can say yes, it's just that you may not be able to say the by when the person does it. So you have to negotiate, okay, well, I can't get to you by Friday, but I can get it to you next Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Will that work for you? Have you found that to work for people?
Yeah, and one of the problems, and this, again, has a biological basis, is that people are notoriously bad at estimating time.
Yeah, right.
Most people think that things will take them a lot less time than they actually, in fact, do take them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good practice to get into to actually pad the amount of time that you allow. And this is not, it's not something that's out of integrity to do that because it's simply an acknowledgement of your own ineffectiveness in managing time.
Yeah. When we send out proposals to people, often what I'll do is, as an example, is I'll say, I'll get it to you by Wednesday, well, it'll work for you. And most of the time they're like, yeah, no problem, you know, because they don't need it right away. But I always, you know, it ends up invariably, I'll get it to them Tuesday. So, but I always give myself an extra couple of days even, because something can come up, right? But then they're not, but if I would have done it the other way around, even though I didn't really need it that badly, if I would have said Tuesday and couldn't get it to them by Wednesday, then they might have been felt put out, even though it wouldn't have mattered that much.
Yeah, even if it doesn't matter to the other person, we do notice these things. We
mm-hmm.
notice that people said,
yep.
I'll get it to you Tuesday, and it came in on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And it's better to have somebody notice that you're impeccable with your word than to notice that, things slide all over the place, and, oh, well, you know, I guess they're just like everybody else, you know, people just don't keep their promises. Rather be put in that first category.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Okay. So what questions do you all have on this request-making system before we move on to the next topic? Nobody has a request? Okay. All right. No problem. I guess it was just very clear. So the next topic is about what I'm calling best practices for work and family integration. What I've noticed is that work and family balance, work and life balance is often out of whack in the Bay Area and with ourselves and with our clients. And the idea of balancing often conjures up a frame of one always getting ripped off, the idea that, okay, so if it's work and family balance or work and life balance, that one gets tipped to the other side. And so I often like to think of it as integration. It doesn't mean that one bleeds into one another. It just means that we just are acknowledging that our work and our family is integrated, and we have to figure out ways to, you know, have boundaries and stay healthy. So what are some ideas you have, Janet, about staying healthy in this?
Well, that's a huge issue, and it's actually one of the things I like about the David Allen system is that he has integrated those tasks. There's not a distinction between your professional and personal life, and I think that in the old days where you had an eight-hour shift and you punched in and you punched out, people could make a very fine delineation. With the number of hours that people are working and the technology that we have that allow us to take work home, it's a much thornier issue now. And my first answer is we really cannot do all of the things that we're doing at the level that we're trying to do it in many cases. So a lot of people are driving themselves crazy with trying to work extraordinary hours at work and also trying to have all of the same family obligations or more that they've always had. And it doesn't work. So one of the things that I work with my clients on is really getting clarity on what their priorities are and making absolute commitments and declarations around the time that they are going to spend on themselves and on their families. So that's a starter, but there's more.
So prioritizing?
Yeah, getting clear that they cannot continue to do it the way they're doing it, that the attempt to do all of the work that comes at them without saying no, and also having this robust family where they're the soccer mom and they're going to all the kids' plays and, you know, the full range of social activities and family activities, that there are some places that they are going to have to say no and put boundaries around.
Right.
And making some really clear commitments about what they will and they won't do.
Right. That's good.
I was amused. I was working with a client last week, and her big breakthrough was she got pissy when an employee interrupted her at 7 o'clock and she couldn't go to her yoga class. And it was the first time that she had experienced getting pissy over that.
At 7 o'clock in the morning or at night?
7 o'clock at night.
Okay.
And this was actually a real indication of progress with her because she had made a declaration that she was going to do this twice a week and that she would make it a priority.
Mm-hmm.
And she realized that she hadn't gotten upset with people for not allowing her to do things like that and that she was making a shift to actually prioritizing that it's not okay for me to bump certain things in my life outside of certain hours.
Cool. That's great. So, Janet, last question for you. What would you do with an extra hour a day?
Oh, gosh. I thought about it. You told me that you were going to ask this question.
Yeah, I kind of gave it to you, yeah.
Yeah, and it really was an interesting thing to think about because my first response to it was, oh, I'd go take a hike or I'd meditate or I'd just spend some alone time. And my next question was, well, why don't I do that now?
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't have an extra hour. And I think it's an interesting question to ask yourself because whatever the answer that comes up is probably a priority that you should be making time for anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we're finding is as we're asking ourselves, and it's been really powerful for us within the company to ask ourselves that question and then to ask. We did a little survey before this particular newsletter we sent out, and it's interesting people's responses. And, you know, yes, the yoga was there, the meditation was there, the spend more time with friends was there. And so, yeah, my question is, so why don't we do that
and
make it a priority?
For me, what's interesting about those responses is that all of those things are capacity-building activities. In other words, we have a certain capacity for work, we have a certain capacity for clear thinking, we have capacity for patience. And I like to think about it like a reservoir. When our reservoir is close to empty on all of those things, it takes us a lot more time to get certain things done. When our reservoirs are full in terms of patience and in terms of clarity of thinking, et cetera, we can do things a lot quicker.
Right.
So oftentimes the activities that get bumped are the ones that actually restore our reservoirs.
I love that, restore reservoir. Our emotional bank account, someone
exactly.
else used that metaphor. So I'd be curious, for those of you who are still on the call, and there are quite a few of you still, because I can tell, anybody want to share what you would do with an extra hour or have some ideas about how you stay healthy in this world of complete overwhelm? Anybody want to share? No pressure.
One of the things that we do in my house is the phone gets turned off. The kids' phones don't get turned off. I don't care if they answer their phone, but we don't answer our phone in the evening.
Ah.
So we just have made, and we started this 20 years ago, just have made a real, we answer the phone if our kids are out, because it might be them.
Mm-hmm.
But we just don't accept that invasion into our private life is reasonable.
Is that cell phones too?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
So what I love about that, and I had actually made a little note but I didn't say it, is in terms of work-life balance, when I was saying you need to make commitments and declarations about your family and stick to them, the next thing I wrote down was, and then you need to allow the system to adjust. So what you've done is you made a declaration around the phone, and I'm sure that your friends and family and your work have figured out that isn't a time to call you.
And it doesn't mean that we can't call out if we want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a flexible system, but we do not I don't believe I'll ever regret working less in my life. I do not believe at the end of my life I'll say, oh, I wish I had, coached another 1,000 hours, right? I don't believe that. I believe that that's a part of my life. And so I don't see any other way to do it but to kind of put up a force field, because the world is very invasive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people have answering machines now. You can get your messages later.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything I'm not saving the world. I'm not negotiating disarmament. There aren't issues that I couldn't wait until the next day. And so I've just decided that they can.
That's great. That's great, Dina. Thank you. Some of the other things that our clients are doing is, doing that yoga class and no matter what. And, obviously their phone is going to be off when they're at the yoga class. And sometimes that's the only time they have during the week that their phone isn't on. But that's a step. Even though that may be a small step, it's still a step. And a lot of them are eating better. We're not dietitians, but it's basically up to the client, what it is of the many things you could do for yourself to be more healthy, what are the things, and let's start and on one or two of them. And then as one tackles one thing, then what else can you start doing? So anyone else have a way they stay healthy through the overwhelm you'd like to share?
This is Angie Cutlick again. There's a couple of things I do. If I want to escape, I just try to find a novel, and I just like to read. It's quiet. It's some alone time. But another thing that we do is we recently bought a Dance Dance Revolution game, and that comes on there. None of us other than the youngest daughter is any good at it, but it's hilarious. It's physical, and it gets us up and moving, and we laugh a lot, and it really helps center us again.
What's the name of it?
Called, you're laughing, Dance Dance Revolution.
Okay, I just didn't hear you. Dance Dance Revolution, okay.
It's in arcades, and they sell it. We have a PS2, and they sell it for the PS2. And, in fact, my daughter, as we speak, has a friend over, and they're playing it as we speak. And our level of ability ranges from lousy, which is me, to my daughter, who is really good. But it's a lot of fun, and it's physical, and it gives us some exercise, and like I said, we laugh an awful lot.
Cool. Sounds fun. So we have a couple of resources here. We've got Dance Dance Revolution. We have David Allen's books. Two have come out in the last couple of years. One is called Getting Things Done, and the most recent one is called Ready for Anything. Janet, do you have a preference for one of those books?
Actually, I have not read the second one.
Okay, so the first one, Getting Things Done, is the one you're using?
It's the classic, yeah.
Okay, the classic from 2 years ago? Okay, all right, great. And then if you want to read about an overwhelmed executive, of course, some of you already know about Leadership Chronicles of a Corporate Sage. That's the book that I wrote last year, and this topic fits in very well because Max, who's in the book, is the quintessential overwhelmed executive, and he goes from being really stressed out to figuring out ways he can mentor better, he can take care of himself better, and take care of his team better. You can get that on, you can get any of these on Amazon.com, of course, at a discount. I wanted to tell you about the next Leadership Forum. It's going to be actually on Tuesday next month, May 24th, at 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Standard Time, or Pacific Daylight Time. And the topic is on cultivating top talent. So we're going to talk a little bit about kind of more big picture in terms of how to cultivate talent, differentiate and identify talent, but also to not let your problem employees zap your energy. And I think that, again, this is another way we feel overwhelmed because we're spending a lot of time with our problem people and letting our top talent sort of do their own thing. So we're going to talk about that. Tell your friends about it. You'll be getting an email from us so that you can forward it on to them. Janet, thank you so much. You have been a complete success. I just so appreciate your cogent responses, and we will be following up with everyone to give you the resources and to make sure you stay in touch with Janet if you'd like to. Thanks again, everybody, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good night.
Good night.